If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Three great words. Free fries Friday. Especially when they're used in that exact order. Get a free medium fries with $1 minimum purchase.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Valid one time on Fridays at participating McDonald's through 12/31/24. Excludes tax. Must update to rewards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, and we're pleased to bring you a very special offer. Subscribe to BBC History Magazine today, and you can choose a book worth up to £30. Choose from either Queens of the Crusades by Alison Weir, The Children of Ashen Elm by Neil Price, Agent Sonia by Ben McIntyre, or The Story of China by Michael Wood. Not only that, you'll also get every issue of BBC History Magazine delivered direct to your door, all from just £22.45. To take advantage of this fantastic offer, visit our official online store at buysubscriptions.com/historybook. This promotion is only available for UK residents and while stocks last. You'll receive your book within 28 days of ordering. Welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's podcast guest is Professor Sujit Sivasundaram, who I spoke to about his book Waves Across the South, A New History of Revolution and Empire. The book offers a new perspective on the expansion of the British Empire across the Indian and Pacific Oceans, arguing that we need to place more emphasis on oceanic communities when thinking about empire, and putting Indigenous voices front and centre.
Your new book offers a new perspective on the expansion of British imperialism across the Indian and Pacific Oceans. To start us off, how has this subject traditionally been written about, and why do you think and how do you think that needs correcting?
Traditionally, the history of the British Empire is written as a galloping kind of story, especially for a public audience. And it's the story of how the British Empire expands across the globe as perceived and seen from London, the nerve center of the British Empire. Traditionally, the later 19th century and the early 20th century figures very heavily in such accounts of the British Empire, the so-called period of high imperialism or new imperialism, which witnessed the partition of Africa and, in terms of territorial extent, the greatest extent of European imperialism across the globe. So traditionally, that would be the period that figures most prominently in history textbooks. Traditionally, I guess, the story is continental as well. So if one wants to think about the 19th century British Empire, India, mainland India, continental India, and the Raj figures very heavily in public memory, as does the partitioning of Africa, as I just mentioned, and settler colonialism more broadly in the late 19th and early 20th century as well.
But why do you think that we need to take a different look at this?
Yes. So the book that I've just written, Waves Across the South, is written from, quite literally, from the Indian and Pacific Oceans. So it's a way of detaching ourselves from this metropolitan view out of London. And arguably, this metropolitan view out of London has generated a marginalization of perspectives, of histories, of narratives from the islands of the Indian and Pacific Oceans in particular, which are small territories. So that's one reason why we need a new perspective. A second reason is that we need a perspective which is environmentally inflected. So this is an oceanic history. It's not as much a continental account of the expansion of the British Empire. And I think because of the way world history moved in the 20th century, retrospectively, we've always imagined empire as sort of land-based, and we just need to kind of think about these oceanic spaces much more fundamentally.
So if we take a look at that oceanic perspective, as you put it, and focus on what you call maritime frontiers, how does that give us a different view of what was happening in this area of the world at this time?
The phrase maritime frontier in the book is partly about warfare. So this period was one of extensive warfare over water, and we sometimes forget that because of our concern with land-based frontiers and land-based wars. So in the book, I track the connections between warfare in Sri Lanka against the Kandyan Kingdom, warfare in Burma against the Kingdom of Ava, and also in Java as just a lineage which provides a sort of example, really, of this maritime conflict and the connections. People moving back and forth, fighters moving back and forth, cultural artifacts moving back and forth, and so on across the Bay of Bengal, linking Burma, Sri Lanka, and Java in this period. And it's a story that has been totally forgotten. So I think it provides a narrative which is distinct, but it also allows these territories and peoples whose histories have been marginalized to come to the front. One could also argue that race and gender is a really critical component of the argument, because I argue that this is a period where intensive comparisons of different people groups, different genders, different cultures is proceeding globally. And one could say that maritime contexts are really crucial for that colonial project, because what you get is communities who colonial forces will say are isolated. You know, there's an island here, then there's an island there, and then there's an island there. And so you can compare and contrast, and you can create a theory of race and gender. Now, that doesn't remember that these communities have very long-standing connections between them. They're not isolated in any way. So one gets this sort of maritime frontier generating a notion of race and gender. Critically for the book, the maritime frontier is also a politically significant one, because the book is arguing that this is a period that gave rise to our idea of rights and our order of politics. And there too, these small spaces and islands can be a way of launching a republican experiment, or launching a colonial state, or launching a heavily militarized regime. And so people are using these spaces as laboratories for politics too. So by way of war, by way of identity, race and gender, by way of politics, just to give three examples, this maritime frontier is really significant in this period.
I want to pick up on the final point you made there about politics, because this is often hailed as the, quote, age of revolution. And you offer a new perspective, saying that we need to see the empire as a story of revolution and counter-revolution. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, thank you. Well, that really gets to the heart of Waves Across the South. So the Age of Revolution story, and I was really struck by this in starting the work for this project, is dominated by the Euro-Atlantic So usually the story is that there are these links between the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, Latin American independence movements, which constitute the age of revolutions. One could bring in the Industrial Revolution, one can bring in the revolutions of 1848 into this story as well. But even if one did that, it's predominantly a Euro-Atlantic story. So what the book does is that it, for the first time, really incredibly, given that so much has been written on the age of revolutions, it takes the story to the Indian and Pacific Oceans. And it argues that here, too, there was an age of revolutions. And it defines the age of revolutions, firstly, as indigenous assertion. So it's about indigenous peoples, it's about islanders, it's about non-European peoples experimenting with politics, with identity, with connection across the sea, with trade, and so forth. And into that space, there comes a really firm imperialism, which is a counter-revolution. So indigenous assertion as revolutionary uprising overtaken by this counter-revolutionary imperialism. And that package, that dynamic, which isn't a full story because, you know, the indigenous peoples can come back, they can rework their politics, they can rework their public consciousness in the light of British imperialism, for instance. So it's not just that one gives way to the other. It's a bit of a dance, really, between alternatives. But that dynamic is what defines the age of revolutions in the Indian and Pacific Oceans.
In the book, there are almost too many examples to choose from, and they're very varied. So we go from, you know, the Persian Gulf down to the Tasman Sea. But I wonder if you could just pick out a couple of examples of how that push and pull of revolution and counter-revolution, as you see it, played out.
Yeah, so one of the places which I really fell in love with in writing this book is the island of Mauritius, where I spent quite a bit of time. And what happens in Mauritius is really interesting because the news of the French Revolution arrives, and immediately assemblies are set up, protest unfolds, Republican sentiment spreads. And at the same time, Mauritius becomes this beacon for a whole series of delegations from across the Indian Ocean, from other people who want to create anti-colonial kind of protest, arguably. A delegation from Burma, a delegation from the Patriots at the frontier in the Cape Colony, and importantly for me, a delegation also from the well-known South Indian ruler who was demonized as an Oriental despot, Tipu Sultan of Mysore. And this is not a story that has been tracked before. So Tipu Sultan of Mysore sends this embassy across to Mauritius, and they try to sort of gather forces for Tipu in South India, right across the Indian Ocean, to fight against the British. Now, the British get hold of this story, and more generally, as they vilify Tipu Sultan of Mysore as an Oriental despot, the information of his connections is really helpful in demonizing him further, and eventually his kingdom falls to the British. So what one sees there really is a long-standing or a long-distance Indian Ocean kind of story being overtaken by the British and British warfare in turn, and looting to and Tipu himself being killed. And so that's a really good example of an unexpected story, but one that highlights how revolution and counter-revolutionary imperialism works. But as you say, the idea of the book was really to kind of track across the vast expanse of the Indian and Pacific Oceans and to bring a diversity of perspectives from across these seas, which haven't been cast together before, whilst illustrating the unexpected connections across these various bits of the Indian and Pacific Oceans.
That actually leads me on to my next question, which is when you're covering such a diverse range of communities and peoples, as you do here, how do you find connections between them enough to, you know, group them together into one book? And what kind of connections did you uncover?
And so what the book does is that it's organized according to these smaller seas, as I call them, the Persian Gulf, the Bay of Bengal, the Tasman Sea, the South Pacific, the Southwest Indian Ocean, which is where the Mauritius story fits. And what I wanted to do was not to override the particularities in each of these locales, because each of them is different with respect to indigenous culture, with respect to imperialism, with respect to geography, and so forth. So in the Southwest Indian Ocean, just to stick with that, since I mentioned Mauritius, next door in the Cape Colony, there's slave revolt, there's Trekboer uprising, there's a whole series of different kinds of movements, Islamic ideas circulating as well amongst slaves. So that's quite a particular story, which is different, say, to the Persian Gulf or the story of Aboriginal Australians or Maori. However, I did want to kind of totally kind of separate out these various seas. And so the idea is that as the book proceeds, the connections become more apparent. Putting these stories together side by side, I think, is also really important today because it's about creating forms of solidarity, really, in the global South, as we think about how to come to terms with imperialism yet again in public debate, and also as we come to terms with environmental change, which is another theme of the book too, actually.
I'll probably pick up on that point about environmental change a little bit later, but a kind of recurrent criticism of many traditional histories of the British Empire are that Indigenous voices are lacking. And people often say, oh, well, you know, there's not as many written sources, so it's a lot harder to reconstruct that. But is that the case? Or what sources can you build on to reconstruct those Indigenous voices and put them front and centre?
Yes. So, well, that's a line I hear often and I've been kind of contending with right through my career and my teaching career as well, where people say, well, there are not any sources to bring in. But to be honest with you, there are huge numbers of sources. The challenge is a linguistic one. And the challenge also is to do with expertise, because very few historians are brave enough to venture beyond their small patch. If they work on Malay sources, or they work on Aboriginal sources, or they work on Maori sources, and so on. And so the story is really divided up between experts. However, I think it's important to get around this idea that there are no voices to be recovered, and also to get around the idea that this the voices should only be kind of presented by certain experts. Because if we follow those two tracks, we can't kind of put together this story in a way that is, you know, that reveals the connections and that reveals the way the story resonates in our present political moment. So just thinking practically, there are a lot of visual sources in the book, and these were useful in terms of recovering Indigenous perspectives. For instance, in the section on New South Wales, where Aboriginal presence and activity is really significant, I did use images quite a lot to think through modes of clothing, to think through gender, to think about the way in which Aboriginal peoples engage with water, especially off Tasmania, which is part of that chapter. And so visual sources can provide clues. But also, I think it's important to kind of read against the grain of colonial sources, to think about their biases, to acknowledge their biases, and then to kind of deconstruct them effectively, or to open them up to other kinds of perspectives. And then, of course, there are plenty of sources in other languages, and I did my best here to use the work of others and to use my own skills as well to integrate such sources into this book, so that it's not simply colonial sources that can't. More broadly, in my work, what I try to do is to juxtapose colonial sources and Indigenous sources, so that these destabilize one another, really, because I think that even the Indigenous sources can have biases, they can be written by elites. So I think we need a diversity of sources set against each other, rather than simply a reliance on particular voices, which are colonial.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And so storms and squalls and hurricanes and waterspouts and ships tossed into the air and ships that run aground in coral reefs and so on feature in the book. And the reason I mention all of that is because, you know, the environment matters.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
So if we take these indigenous sources and, as you say, juxtapose them with colonial sources, what kind of a picture does that present of the interactions that were taking place between imperialists and indigenous people in this era?
Sure, there's a lot of exchange, and that's one of the points of the book. And I use the idea of raiding, quite literally ships being raided by indigenous peoples for stuff and also for ideas as a way of talking about this. A whole series of ideas, Republican ideas, royalist ideas are circulating. And these can be useful for indigenous peoples. So to give one particular example, one of the arguments in the book concerns monarchy in the Pacific, where I show that new monarchic lines are inaugurated in the Pacific in the Age of Revolutions, and that this is not a surprise in some ways because it's part of the Age of Revolution story. And so what you get is, you know, Pacific explorers, certainly Captain Cook, but lots of other explorers, French explorers who I discuss in the book, who haven't arguably been considered as much in the English language literature, they come along and they say, you know, where's the king? Where's the queen? And of course, this is not a place where one has a European sense of royalty. And then indigenous peoples will take those ideas and use them to create their own monarchic lines for their own purposes. And so that's one example of ideas arriving and being taken from ships.
I think that's interesting because so often we assume that these would be, when we think about, say, globalization, these would be ideas imposed by imperialists, but you're saying that they were actively taken by indigenous peoples.
So what I'm saying is that there are certainly traditions which already exist in that example of chieftaincy, which are reformulated in line with the arrival of these new ideas connected with monarchy. So there's dramatic change in this period. Once you have a monarchic line initiated, that becomes quite useful for colonialism as well, because you have a representative with whom you can bargain, with whom you can sign a treaty. And so, again, it's that dance of alternatives of revolution and imperialism, which I mentioned earlier. There's give and take on all sides, and there certainly is imposition as well as exchange in the story.
That does highlight an interesting point in the book, that the expansion of empire was not just simply a military thing. Can you give some more examples of the other forms that it took?
Yeah, so I don't want to minimize the military aspect of it, because I think it was violent. But that's a story that we know already. I wanted to emphasize the looting and the cultural life, really, of warfare, the number of Buddha statues which were taken in Burma, and the amount of botanical specimens that were collected in the midst of war as well. So I think when we think about warfare, we've got to think about culture and cultural looting, and indigenous peoples also taking cultural artifacts for their own purposes, weapons in the Pacific being used like this figure in the book. So warfare leads into culture, leads into objects. And another very important theme for the book is knowledge and science in particular. And here one can think of a whole series of experiments about, you know, astronomical experiments, botanical collecting enterprises, and so on, which really thrive in this age of revolutions, because it's an age where understanding is seen to be expanding, colonial understanding. And indigenous peoples, in turn, are kind of quite curious about this and are co-opted as helpers, as assistants, for language study, for collecting specimens, for observing the stars, and so on. And so that, too, is a space where one sees this exchange, which is tied to militarism, because it's about surveillance, it's about information that's useful for war, too. But, you know, it's not just military in a narrow sense.
So when you dig into it, it's actually a very complicated picture, a web almost, isn't it, of different motivations and different interactions. Must be quite hard to unpick that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think imperialism is complicated, but I mean, that doesn't deny that it's violent and that it's powerful. And that's partly why I use the language of counter-revolution, because it suppresses the possibilities of this period. So if we think about revolution, as I define it here, as indigenous assertion, it's about the hopes, the expectations, the possibilities for the future that seafaring peoples in the Indian and Pacific Oceans had. An empire is suppressing that. So we need to not lose sight of that headline. But when we dig beneath that, the way it does that is very, very clever, because it actually kind of relies on indigenous expertise. It relies on indigenous assistance. And it actually sort of covers not just brute militarism, but culture, knowledge, and so on as well, and trade.
Mm-hmm. Just to circle back around to something you mentioned earlier about the importance you wanted to place on environment and environmentalism, how do you think that the progress of the British Empire was shaped by geography and the natural environment?
Yeah, so the book is an oceanic history, and so storms and squalls and hurricanes and waterspouts and ships tossed into the air and ships that run aground in coral reefs and so on feature in the book. And the reason I mention all of that is because, you know, the environment matters. It's not just simply the case that you have, you know, either indigenous assertion or imperial counter-revolt operating on a blank slate. This is a watery terrain, which is difficult to navigate in this period. So we need to kind of keep that in mind. And the way it relates to the argument about the Age of Revolutions is that indigenous peoples have arguably a pretty advanced sense of the terrain. And they have contemplated the sea for their sense of self, for their narratives of history, and so on. And so when empire comes along, the British Empire, the French Empire, the Dutch Empire too, they need to contend with that environmental knowledge that already exists. And so one of the things which I found really interesting to track is that as we go through the Age of Revolutions into the 1830s, into the 1840s, you get whalers transforming themselves into harbor masters, transforming themselves into hotel owners, transforming themselves into people who keep cattle. And so what you get is the transition of that whole maritime complex, which was mobile, which sometimes was, you didn't quite know what was going to happen next, as I was saying, into something which is much more settled. Settled used in many senses here. Settled isn't just fixed, but also on land. And, you know, and so one gives way to the other too. And that once again is an environmental dimension to the argument, which is in keeping with what a counter-revolution is. It moves across the sea and then it just sort of, you know, goes plonk on land, and you get these huge port cities like Singapore, which is in the book, emerging as mega cities of free trade in the terms of the period.
So you mentioned earlier that another aspect of this age was this desire almost to classify people and compare them, most significantly along the lines of race and gender. How did that play out in this context?
So there's a lot of racism, and I was struck by this reading the book in print once again, actually. There's so much racism in the sources, in the words used, in the terms of description used. And the book actually ends with an account of how history itself was born out of this story, meaning that people started to write the history of the British Empire at the end of the Age of Revolutions. There's a guy, Robert Montgomery Martin, who features at the end of the book, who astonishingly, and I'm quite scared thinking about it, published 267 books on the British Empire.
Now, better get a move on.
I'm not going to compete. I don't want to compete, actually. but there's an important reason why I don't want to compete, which is basically he went traveling across many of the places that the book is about. He also worked in Hong Kong. And then he sort of just stationed himself in London and had access to all the statistical returns from the colonies. But he collected skeletons, indigenous people's skeletons and remains. And so the origins of British imperial history comes out of this sort of racism, and one needs to contend with it. And so if one then kind of moves back, one has to kind of peel back all of that printing. All the 267 books effectively have been taken back. And then all the novels that were written, some by people who feature in the book as historical figures, a guy called Marriott, who was in the war in Burma, and publishes novels based on the Pacific. One has to take back all of that print and realize that actually at the core of it was the collection of indigenous cultures and sometimes extremely disturbingly indigenous remains as well. And so that's why race and gender have to be really at the heart of the story. Now, one place where the argument is developed is in New South Wales, as I mentioned earlier. And here what was striking was just the racial depiction of indigenous peoples and the classification of these peoples, on the one hand, with regard to their attitudes to water. You know, were they so-called nomadic peoples? Were they? How did they assist explorers? In indigenous peoples in Tasmania, how did they commune with seals? Because this is a period where the sealing trade is expanding. So these sorts of questions, which are environmental questions, but also ethnological and anthropological questions, become about classifying peoples. You know, how are the Tasmanians different to the Maori? How are the Maori different to mainland Australian Aboriginal peoples? And then you depict these peoples in print and so on. So that's what's going on in the period. And then it leads into the Robert Montgomery Martin kind of story, which I just told you, which is the origins of the history, the historical writing of the British Empire.
Something that I was surprised to read about, which ties into the point of the Age of Revolutions and how it played out in this area, was about the impact of abolition across the Pacific and Indian Oceans, because I think that two areas of history that many people wouldn't connect in their minds. How did you find that it played out in the Indian and Pacific Oceans?
The argument is that debates about abolition and emancipation in particular feed growing public spheres in the Indian and Pacific Ocean port cities. And here, Cape Town and Mauritius feature prominently in the account. So yes, I mean, people think about the Atlantic Ocean when they think about enslavement. And that's right, because it's the critical ocean with which to think in considering histories of slavery. But they don't remember then that there is a history of coerced labor in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean as well. First, to feed plantation colonies. Then, after the abolition of slavery and emancipation, using indentured Indian laborers across the Indian and Pacific Oceans too. So I wanted to bring that story in to this book, because arguably it's an Age of Revolution story. Abolition, allegedly the kind of change of the status of enslaved labor, is part and parcel of what the Age of Revolutions is in the Atlantic. And if so, it should be in the Indian and Pacific Oceans as well.
You were able to, of course, travel across to some spectacular places while writing this book across the Indian and Pacific Oceans. How is the history of empire remembered today in those parts of the world in ways that might be different from, if a lot of our listeners are from Britain and America, the ways that perhaps we would be taught about it or remember it?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, really privileged to travel in these places, talk to local scholars and to work in local archives. And the stories that they told actually fed in to the book. And so that's just a basic answer to your question, because actually there are lots of stories which one gets from talking to local scholars, which are just absolutely unknown in Britain. For instance, stories about slavery and in Mauritius, for instance, or stories, or one witnesses the memorials to war. One looks at the sources which are available in archives in these locations, which are totally different, much more granular than the sources that you can get, say, in a place like the British Library, which has high-level colonial sources. So practically, just in terms of the stories and the sources, you get something quite different. But certainly, the narratives are remembered differently as well. So just one example from the Pacific was a story about William Mariner, which features in one of the chapters. He's a young man. He arrives. It's a shipwreck. He's stranded in Tonga. His ship is raided. Various things are taken off it, armament, weapons. He himself, Mariner, becomes an advisor to local Tongans in wars that they undertake prior to into the consolidation of a monarchic line in Tonga. Now, the story, as told in colonial sources, is that there's a massacre. Lots of the people on the ship were killed by Tongans. But the story, as told in Tonga, is that actually these people on the ship, which was a private ship, were out raiding. They were kind of killing huge numbers of whales, and they were kind of, you know, looting islands. And so what you get there is, you know, the contrast. We remember the massacre of on a European ship, but we don't remember then the violence that ship is involved in turn. And so it's that kind of change of perspective that's necessary. But also the two stories need to be told side by side. So when I tell the story of William Mariner, I actually end that section by mentioning how Tongan scholars and people remember the story and how it's a different perspective. And so it's keeping in view these multiple perspectives, I think, which is significant.
So how would you want us to amend our view of the British Empire?
Well, I think fundamentally I want to say that there are a multiplicity of histories of the British Empire. This is not the only history of the British Empire in this period. But I think it's a significant history because it's one that's been marginalized and hasn't been told. All of the places, many of the places that I kind of bring into the book have not featured very heavily in histories of the British Empire. And certainly this period of the history of the British Empire, the late 18th and early 19th century in the East, is also arguably less well served than the later period, as I said earlier. But to return to the main point, I think we need a multiplicity of histories because we have got used to this galloping universal history out of London, and that is no longer fit for purpose in our times, because we need to engage with a whole series of populations in the wider world, as well as in Britain itself, and they require a whole range of different histories to be told.
That was Sujit Sivasundaram. Waves Across the South, A New History of Revolution and Empire, is on sale now, published by HarperCollins. Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow to hear Simon Hall discussing his book about Fidel Castro in Harlem.